It is 8:29, and we have with us once again, live in the studios, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Wait a minute, are we on the clock yet?
No, technically, I was trying to squeeze a free minute out of you.
Oh, well, we'll have to charge the same rate we charge for the rest of the half hour.
Yeah, well, at least
plus
that's better.
50%.
That's
yeah.
better
Time
than you
and
guys
half.
Going silent on me. For
So how was your holiday, Mike? We never hear from you this half
you know,
hour.
Oh, it's generally the Christmas time, the holiday season, isn't actually my favorite time of year. As it is for some other people, which I don't think any of them are in this room right now. But
we're both really, really into shopping, as you could probably tell.
Yeah,
we are.
Oh, I forgot to clear that bit with you ahead of time, didn't I?
So that must be some gene or something that I missed out on.
Yeah,
some part of the X chromosome I didn't get.
Well, I think I'm missing the entire DNA strand when it goes to that, personally, as any quick look at me can ascertain. I did buy clothes once in 1978. That was an interesting year.
That would explain the bright patterns. So, hey, let's jump into this week's stuff, because there's a ton to cover. It looks like there's plenty of coverage in the media of mad cows. They appear to be beyond the White House now.
Well, I think it's kind of funny that George Bush said he was going to continue eating meat as if anybody cared, because he doesn't really have a brain, so.
Yeah, it's already turned to, you know, spongy material that doesn't really hold anything. That's
right.
Kind of sad.
I just want to talk about it a little bit from the perspective of somebody who grew up on a dairy farm, so I know a little bit about this whole mad cow disease thing and a little bit about why this cow got through the system and why there are many, many cows who have gotten through the system who probably also have the disease that we simply have no idea because they were never tested. Now, when I was growing up on a dairy farm some 20, 25 years ago, most of the dairy farms around were family farms. You had something from 25 to 100 cows on the farm, and you could give them individual attention and take care of them, and you knew when a cow was sick and when a cow was not sick. On a dairy farm nowadays, you have something like 1,000 to 5,000 cows. This cow, in particular, that tested positive for mad cow disease came off of a farm with 4,000 animals. Now, there's only one way you can milk 4,000 animals every day, and that's to turn those cows into cogs in a machine. Basically, they're lined up. They're pushed through a barn where it's all mechanized. The milkers are timed to fall off the cow after about 4 minutes. And let me tell you that a cow, it can take her anywhere from 2 minutes to 15 minutes to milk out completely. So any animal that doesn't fit into that four-minute mode is going to be abused by the system. Now, what happens is that on a family farm, 25 years ago, on a family farm, a cow could live anywhere from 10 years to 15 years to almost 20 years. That would be her lifespan, and she'd have a pretty good life for a cow. Nowadays, on a mechanized farm, the average lifespan of a cow is about 2 years in the herd. Now, given that it takes about a year and a half for a cow to become old enough to have their first calf and to go into the milk string, that's about 3.5 to 4 years is the total lifespan of the average cow on a dairy farm. Now, it takes anywhere from 5 to 7 years for symptoms of mad cow disease to become apparent, for a cow to begin staggering around and to have trouble walking. So if a cow goes to slaughter when she's 3.5 to 4 years old and there's you know, not time for symptoms of mad cow disease to manifest, then you have to ask yourself, how many cows have we slaughtered? How many dairy cows have gone into the hamburger supply that we simply don't know have this disease? So there's a question there. The main question is our mechanized form of milk production, our mechanized form of beef production, a big part of the problem? And it certainly is.
And it's not just a problem with mad cow disease also. There's any number of meat safety things that are sort of slipping through the system at this point.
In addition to the animal cruelty issue,
too. Very much so.
Now, there's a... In a there's also the practice of slaughtering downer cows in the first place. When I was growing up, you didn't slaughter downer cows. They simply didn't go for meat. Now, nowadays, among the millions and millions and millions of cows that get butchered every year to make up your hamburger, about 130,000 of them are cows.
Say what a downer cow is.
Now, downer cows are animals that have trouble walking for one reason or another. We used to refer to them as animals that had trouble walking, not from injury. Say they were hit by another cow and their hip joint was damaged, but they were downer cows because they were obviously sick for some reason. They obviously had some kind of illness that made them unable to walk or made it hard for them to walk or affected their balance. In that case, you could, if you were a farmer on a family farm, you knew that the animal was sick. You did not send that animal to the butcher, and they didn't accept it. You know, nowadays, so many animals are processed, and it's such a cutthroat economic business that they take anything and everything that can get up off the truck.
Yeah, and it goes into the human food supply.
That's not just into grain.
That's exactly right.
Now, yeah. I found an interesting statistic this week as well. I was reading a little bit about some of the cases in England and some of the human cases of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease here in the United States. And it shocked me. You know, you would think, oh, maybe three people get Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease in the United States. Well, you'd be wrong. It's 300 new cases every year, human cases of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease diagnosed every year.
What's called the mad cow disease. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah. The human variant of spongiform encephalopathy is Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. Now, they don't know where it comes from. And you occasionally get this statistic from experts who say, well, there have been no confirmed cases of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease in the human, you know, form here in the United States. And what they're really telling you is that they didn't take these people who were diagnosed with Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease who've died, and they didn't do an autopsy on them. And you know why? They didn't want to cut open the skull, and they didn't want to handle the brain tissue in a controlled laboratory situation, because it is so easy to actually get the disease from handling the brain tissue, even in a sterile laboratory situation. And now they're trying to tell us that this cow that tested positive for mad cow disease, that they put her through the slaughter process and a machine ripped her brain and her spinal cord out of the carcass, and that means the rest of the cow is safe. Well, what they don't tell you is that machine leaves behind spinal tissue, and that spinal tissue then gets ground up along with portions of the carcass and goes into your hamburger and your sausage and the meat for your pizza and your bologna and everything else. It actually goes into the food supply. Now, you might say, oh, Maria, you don't really know that. Well, I do know that, and the FDA knows it too. The FDA actually did a survey in 2002 that found that some 33% of the meat that goes through that mechanized process where it strips out the spinal cord tissue leaves behind spinal cord tissue that then ends up in the human food supply. So you're actually eating it.
I really feel like some bacon this morning, don't you, Mike?
Well, there's another problem, too. Even if you don't eat meat, you're still getting exposed to this stuff.
And it's not just cows, also, we should explain. I mean, there was a reason why I said that, is because we're having problems with food safety and all the kinds of different meats, not just beef.
Yeah. Just speaking in terms of mad cow disease, a lot of this, you might ask, okay, where does the brain and spinal cord tissue go when it gets pulled out of the carcass, the stuff that doesn't remain behind? Well, that gets ground up and it gets put into food for chickens and pigs and pet food. Now, chickens, what you might not know, when you go to your co-op to buy your organic vegetables, a lot of the fertilizer that you use to grow organic food is made from chicken manure. So now the reason why they feed this stuff to chickens is because they figure that the chicken's digestive tract will not absorb prions. The mad cow disease, it is a prion. It's not a bacteria. It's not a virus. It's a little very, very, very simple and very hard to kill protein, misshapen protein called a prion. Now, they think that experts think that the chicken's digestive tract does not absorb the prion because they haven't observed chickens getting mad chicken disease. They think that it actually passes through the chicken's gut and into the chicken manure. But that chicken manure gets put into the human food chain because it's used to fertilize plants that grow organic vegetables. So if you eat organic carrots and organic potatoes, you want to scrub those things as well as you can. You may even want to peel them.
Or any kind of root vegetable.
Yeah, any kind of root vegetable because there, again, you're getting exposed to it.
All right, so I'm not going to be serving pet food to my guests anymore.
Either of them.
This is pretty disturbing, and we'd actually been talking about this the other day, and one of the terms that came up was this was an accident waiting to happen, but it actually sounds like, I mean, the way they've got this system designed, this isn't no accident. This is like, this was bound to happen.
It was interesting, too, because the way that the cattle industry immediately came out, like they had the speeches all prepared, you know, that we've got it covered.
Well, they did.
Yeah. We've got it covered, you know, the food supply is safe, yada, yada, yada. And it's because they were expecting this to happen eventually.
Yeah, and the USDA and the various federal and state agencies that inspect the food supply, particularly the meat supply, I mean, the enforcement budgets have been gutted, you know, all of the different hoops that you have to jump through in order to get you know, food into the food supply has really, I mean, it's been greased for agribusiness over the past 20 years, and that's been a bipartisan effort.
Yeah, and even the plants that are known violators, plants that take animal tissue and put it into feed for cattle, or are not really good at separating out the feed that's made for chickens from the feed that's made from cattle and cleaning the machine in between, those companies aren't even inspected on a fairly regular basis. There was there's a company that has had numerous violations related to that sort of thing.
That's
here
the one
in
down
Tacoma.
In Centralia?
No, the one here in Tacoma. I'm thinking of XL Feeds. The one here in Tacoma that over a 13-year period had multiple violations, it was inspected only 5 times. And if the Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration know there's a company that's got a violation, you would think they'd be out there looking at it more than 5 times in 13 years and trying to do something about it, when it was only in 2002 when the company was really slapped hard for these violations that have been going on since 1989.
Yeah, and the bar that you have to reach to qualify for committing a violation has also been raised quite a bit over the past number of years.
It has.
Well, it sounds like this is something that we're going to be coming back and revisiting because it's not going away.
It's not going away.
No, not at all.
So, all right, well, let's move along. The upcoming issue of Eat the State is going to contain some of this year's most overhyped and underreported stories, and you guys are going to share some of those with us now.
Yes, as a matter of fact, if you eat a steak, you don't have any of these risks.
Better to eat a steak than eat a steak.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the steak is fed with a certain kind of manure. It's true, but it's somewhat different. Each year, for really since the beginning of ETS, I think we did it our first year in 1996. We've had a list at the end of the year, which is a way of writing a nice long story that we can do in advance so we don't have to do a whole lot over the holidays, of the most overhyped and underreported stories of the year. And we are doing that again this year. It'll be in the issue that comes out on Wednesday. I'll have a national version of it. My working for Chain Column this week also, but that doesn't include all of the good local stuff. And let's face it, in Eat the State, you can say some things that you wouldn't say in other places. So it was an awfully productive year, both for the overhyped and underreported. And you know, just parenthetically, particularly with the election coming up and with the fate of a back in our hands and whatnot. I mean, the fact that the bread and circuses aspect of our media just seems to be getting worse from year to year. And the internet is really coming into its own as an alternative source, both from alternative news sources in this country and the ability to access foreign media. It's really become more important than ever to seek out alternative and foreign news sources and not just take what you see on TV or in the daily papers for granted, because they're missing an awful lot. And an awful lot of what is reported is either not reported completely, or it's done from a bias toward power, or it gets drowned in Michael Jackson and Kobe Bryantitis, which was one of the overhyped stories. But the two overhyped, and I'll just spend a couple minutes on those because those aren't really as important, weren't so much overhyped in terms of our winners as they were simply fictitious. And that would be the saving of Jessica Lynch and the toppling of the Saddam statue. And there's actually a third official story that's now coming under question, which was the whole question of whether the Kurds had tracked down and handed over Saddam to the Americans, and the U.S. Told a somewhat incomplete version of the capture of Saddam Hussein, which made the U.S. military and government more out to a more heroic role than they otherwise would have. But both with the toppling of Saddam and especially with the supposed rescue of Jessica Lynch, we had episodes of our government, not just hyping something, but out and out making a conscious and protracted and extremely elaborate effort to sell a fable to the American public. They simply lied.
Which was true about Saddam Hussein's chemical and biological weapons as well.
Oh, absolutely. For that matter, most of the justifications
for the invasion of Iraq.
So all of that was overhyped, and of course the underreported aspects of that were included. That many of those justifications throughout the last half of last year and the beginning of this year were easily and immediately discredited. It wasn't just a question that several months after the invasion happened and it was all a fait accompli, we started discovering that this stuff was misleading. We talked about it on this program every week.
We talked about it before the invasion. Yeah.
Repeatedly. And, many of our people listening are aware of that. And, many of the people who were out in the streets were aware of that. Other overhyped stories, Arnold Schwarzenegger running for governor, the fact that he was able to do it on Jay Leno and E! Without ever having to actually answer a policy question was remarkable. Hopefully a precedent that won't be repeated, but it probably will be. The whole selling of the economic recovery, which is a little bit different from last year, because last year we were just told that it's around the corner endlessly when it wasn't. This year we were told that it's here and it's permanent and it's glorious, when in fact we've got some indices that are a little bit of a blip on the radar, but don't change a lot of the more worrisome long-term trends. So that's very much been overhyped. And by the way, what on earth is a jobless recovery good for anyway? We had the whole fiasco locally around Boeing and the 787 plant. We're talking about somewhere between 800 and 1,000 jobs total. For which it pencils out by the time Gary Locke finished giving his lavishly wrapped gifts to Boeing, you balance out the tax gifts and the other incentives that Boeing were given versus the positive effects to the economy, not just the immediate effects of what Boeing would pay the state, but the ripple effects all the way through the economy, and it still pencils out to $3.2 million per job that the state is giving Boeing. And that doesn't mean the state's giving it to Boeing. That means you and I are. It was sold to us as this wonderful, glorious thing. For that matter, we're talking about corruption. You have to talk about Strippergate and the whole idea that a parking lot at a strip joint in Lake Union is a better indice of...
Lake City.
I'm sorry. I was getting ahead of myself. It's a better indice of local political corruption than the entire South Lake Union neighborhood.
Project, yeah.
Yeah, which gets us to the... most underreported stories. And locally, the fact that Paul Allen seems to have Greg Nichols and a substantial portion of the rest of the city of Seattle's political leadership by their cojones seems to be something that local media doesn't really want to talk about either. But you have a process now by which Allen and Nichols are really ramming through, really taking pretty serious liberties with the established planning processes in Seattle in order to get Allen the utility infrastructure, the transportation wish lists that he wants, all sorts of other tax incentives in order to develop his properties on South Lake Union and south of downtown in the Soto neighborhood, which are really the only two directions that downtown can grow. You really don't have very many major cities in this country that where one guy owns so much of the valuable real estate, and he also seems to own quite a bit of the city's political leadership. That's not talked about much. And I think also on the local list, you have to talk about transportation. There was an amazing story this year of the study that I believe it was a state DOT did that sometime coming up very soon, forget about the Alaskan Way Viaduct and 520, both of which are well along in the planning process for expensive options with very little public input and no idea of how agencies are going to pay for the repairs or the new
the
new pavement.
Yeah,
the new pavement that's going to be needed. We're going to have to tear up and replace, not just rebuild, but replace I-5 all the way through Seattle. It was built over 40 years ago. It was only designed to last 25 years. It's obviously got a much higher volume of traffic than was ever planned for, and I-5 is falling apart going through Seattle. Now, if you can imagine what traffic in Seattle is going to be like if they're ripping up the viaduct and ripping up I-5 all the way through the city.
And exactly how much that's going to cost. We're going to want those tax dollars back from Boeing, aren't we?
We're going to need more than that, too. Mm-hmm. And really, the only place to get it is the corporate welfare that goes out for companies like Boeing and locally for, Immunex and some of these other companies. For that matter, that's another underreported story of even in these tough budget times, that's the one thing that at the state and local level that just never seems to get cut. Is the fair share of taxes actually being paid by some of these businesses rather than they're being able to skip out on their bills? Nationally, there's an awful lot, and of course, it kind of has to start with Iraq. That's just been a cesspool of underreported stories over this year. And we were talking at the beginning of the year of how you can narrow them down or group them. Beginning of the program, I'm sorry, we were off air about how to narrow them down and regroup them, how to group them. Civilian casualties is one. The total incompetence of the U.S. administration of Iraq in terms of providing basic services is another. The really forestalling the active efforts by the United States to ensure that Iraq does not have democracy, and that goes everything from bringing in UN and other agencies that have experience in nation building to not trying to lay the groundwork for the kind of civil society institutions that you need to develop democracy, to parachuting in all of the various exile groups and buddies of the Pentagon. And
allowing them to set up their own militias.
Yeah, allowing them to set up their own mafias, really, because it's not just militias, it's also about economic
and
exploitation.
Right down to awarding subcontracts to exile groups rather than to local firms.
Yeah,
it really is a broad and almost, you'd have to say, planned way that the Bush administration has gone about pretty much sabotaging democracy in Iraq rather than setting it up.
Yeah, and if you mix that in with the enormous privatization scheme that the Bush administration has foisted off on Iraq, much more so than the IMF or anybody has ever proposed for a country in the global south before.
Includes paying Bechtel and Halliburton billions of dollars to do almost nothing.
Yeah. And even if any kind of limited self-rule with hand-picked Washington politicians is foisted off on Iraq next year, the cupboard's going to be bare by the time they inherit it because all of the major decisions, all the major resources will have been safely removed offshore.
The cupboards will be bare and they'll be deeply in debt.
Yep. So that's Iraq, and then of course the casualties as well that that have happened there really have not been talked about. There have been a number of other stories this year outside Iraq. Afghanistan is almost entirely forgotten. The fact that the Taliban is quietly making a comeback there, the fact that the United States, after promising not to, has basically abandoned the country that Mr. Hamid Karzai, our CIA man in power there, really only has control of Kabul, and that only during day late hours. It's the same old gang of rapists and murderers that are and drug runners that are controlling the rest of the country. You have a number of other stories. Of course, the peace movement was Reich being the overarching theme here, and that of course also has not been particularly well reported. On the economic front, we have the impact of the ongoing joblessness and economic troubles. We also have the corporate corruption continues to run amok, and that the tax cuts have been a complete failure economically. The reforms that were put in place to rein in corporate corruption has been a joke.
Yeah, the tax cuts helped the stock market, but they didn't do a heck of a lot else.
Yeah, they were a success in terms of George Bush's buddies. Yes,
yeah, they helped rich people, but they didn't help a whole lot.
We have heard very little about the real conflict in the Middle East that the rest of the world cares most about, which is Israel and Palestine, and particularly the apartheid wall that's being built there, and the U.S. role in supporting the brutalization of Palestinians by Israel. We have heard almost nothing this year about Africa, and there have been a number of huge stories in Africa, from the war in Central Africa to AIDS to renewed brutalization in Nigeria. The U.S. role of companies there in exploiting natural resources, a lot of important stories in Africa that are not covered simply because it's Africa. Civil liberties, Bush and the Constitution continues to be a major issue. And then just, you know, overall, the fact that we have the United States continuing to be the biggest terrorist nation in the world. I mean, that really seems to be a running theme that we're supporting bad guys. You know, in the battle of good against evil, we seem to have an awful lot of evil people on our side. Those are all stories that we need to be looking at more in 2004. And, you know, there's some others here we don't really have time to go into, but it will all be in Eat the State this week.
Man, that's going to be a big issue.
Yep. Sure enough.
We have a couple minutes left, not really enough time to cover a lot of it, but perhaps, Maria, you can give us kind of a short version of This Week in Iraq.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about a couple quick things. In the short period from Christmas Eve through yesterday, which was Friday, the day after Christmas, some 10 U.S. soldiers died. Well, actually, 8 of them died in those past 3 days. 2 of them died earlier in the week, a total of 10 this week. And unnumbered and uncounted numbers of Iraqi civilians. The guerrillas expanded the war to the city of Erbil in northern Iraq, which is in the Kurdish zone, where no attacks had been previously reported and where U.S. soldiers had been able to walk the streets unarmed and without having to be in tanks and armored vehicles. 4 soldiers were killed there and 6 civilians in a suicide bombing. So the guerrillas are actually expanding their territory. On Christmas,
I thought they were going to give up after Saddam was captured.
That's what we were led to believe, but it's not true. On Christmas Day, there were meetings between members of the Iraqi Governing Council and Iraq's most prominent Shiite cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, regarding the process for selecting or electing members of a provisional National Assembly that will take over running Iraq next June. Well, Ali Sistani, the Shiite cleric, emphasized yet again that he supports elections, and he said that he would only give up supporting elections if a UN technical team came in, did a survey of the country, and decided that it was simply not possible to do elections, and if they came up with a better system of selecting members for the Provisional Council than the one that the U.S. has proposed.
Which gets back to the original point that we made a few minutes ago about U.S. being the force that's getting in the way of democracy.
Right. And he has continued to refuse to meet with Paul Bremer and with any other member of the Coalition Provisional Authority. He's only meeting with governing council members, and he has now said that he wants this. In this statement, he has said that he wants the UN to come in, which is absolutely the opposite of what the U.S. is doing. The U.S. is trying to shut out the UN in the democratic process in Iraq. So I wanted to make that point about Iraq. That's pretty much ties up what I have to say about this week in Iraq this week.
Very good. Well, with that, we're pretty much out of time for
the
this
year
segment and for
the year.
Talking once again with Job Parish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And one last time for this year, tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you find free publications around town and around on the east side as well. If you want to find us online, we're at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you think we should have included something in the year's most underreported and overhyped stories, you can give us a call at 903-9461, area code 206.